it's that thing of paying attention amidst the whole broad expanse of spaciousness that we've got at our disposal. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. This is episode 74 of Art Juice, honest, generous, and humorous conversations that will feed your creative soul and get you thinking, with me, Alice Sheridan.
And me, Louise Fletcher.
And today we are going to be talking about, basically, it's an idea that came up after last week's interview that we did with Brian Ruttenberg, which, you guys, what a response it has been. It has been lovely seeing your messages. I know lots of you have been followers of his for a long time, but we have been getting emails and comments just to say how much you really enjoyed that conversation, and we did too. And we've passed some of those on to him, and he is equally thrilled. So he says, thank you very much for the book sales. but more than that, you know, it's just really nice to be able to pass on some of that and feel that you guys are inspired. So if you haven't listened to that, hop back and listen to episode 73. That was last week. And if you enjoy listening to us here at Art Juice, can we ask a favor? Somebody has alerted us that there are some podcast awards around, and we would love to have your vote. So this will just take 2 seconds. If you could go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote. And when you get to that page, you just type in Art Juice to search for us and vote for us. And it's as simple as that. That would be fantastic. Thank you. So we've got a few little hangovers from that week that we are going to just introduce into the show just as a surprise for you today. But our main conversation is going to be around the area of how we balance thinking and feeling, which I know is something that I struggle with. So I'm looking forward to seeing where that conversation goes.
Yeah, me too.
First of all, what have you been working on this week, Louise?
Well, I have been really knee-deep in preparations to launch my free course, which I do once a year. So warning, plug time, everybody. Come and sign up in 2 weeks' time. So this actually in 1 week's time when this goes out. So June the 15th, for 1 week, I open up my doors. I spend a whole week, like full on, every minute of every day teaching this free workshop. There's lessons, there's live chats, there's email answers, there's and really it's a taster for my full course, but I teach it to many, many people who have no intention of taking the full course, which is totally fine. I just love sparking everybody's creativity. And the week is about painting free, loosening up, and it's interesting. So this week I've been talking to people who took it, who took my full course last year, who are going to help me moderate the group for the free course, who are going to come in and just help me manage the amount of people that we're going to have, help answer questions, etc. And in talking to them, what's been fascinating is, you know, there's this thing in marketing we've talked about before about finding your avatar, your ideal customer.
Yeah.
Well, in these conversations, I can see who they are. It's so interesting. So if you are a beginner who knows kind of about composition and color and has all these ideas but doesn't know what to paint, this week's for you. If you went to art school and then got totally stuck and stymied and didn't know where to go and haven't painted since, this is for you. And if you're a professional artist or, you know, a serious amateur who's been making art for other people, especially commissions or to sell in galleries, and now feels like you've lost your way with that and you want to make something that feels like you, this week's for you. So it's really a week about finding who you are, what you want to say, and how you want to say it. So I've been busy doing that and corralling these wonderful, I think it's now 30 people who are going to help me.
Wow.
It's amazing. And so we had a Zoom call yesterday afternoon and went through, and they had some great ideas, and they all offered to even answer emails as well, because I get so many emails during it. So it's like we got this team going now of prior Find Your Joy people, and they're all doing it as volunteers, and they're all doing it just because they really want to help other people to kind of get that momentum going so that they feel like they can make their own work. So I'm really looking forward to it. So it's June 15th. And if you want to join us, you can find it on my website, right on my homepage. There's a link to sign up.
What's your website?
Or it'll be in the show notes.
Come on, what's your website?
LouiseFletcherArt.com.
Okay.
And actually, while we're on this, whenever we say it's in the show notes, I don't think people know what that means, because I had all sorts of emails from people asking how they can get Brian's book, and it was in the show notes. So wherever you listen to this, if you listen on Apple Podcasts on your phone, then right below where the title is and everything, the show notes are there. It's a description of the episode and links. If you listen on Spotify, same thing. If you listen on either of our websites, it's always on our blog and the links are always there. So anytime we mention it's in the show notes, wherever you're listening, the show notes are there. You just have to look for them.
Yeah, that used to really confuse me. I remember listening to podcasts and thinking, what are they talking about? But sometimes it can be a little bit hidden, can't it? There's, you have to scroll up and you're there to listen, and often you don't do it. But if you scroll a bit further down the screen, the written notes are there. And both Louise and I, on our website, sit up in our menu, we have a four artists and then there's podcast. And that has got all the previous episodes. So if you're not an app person user, you can listen directly on the website. And that often has extra images. We don't do a huge amount extra in the show notes, but there are often extra images, and you have links for anything that you can follow. So that's three different places that you can find it. But yeah, good point, because that used to confuse the heck out of me as well.
So what have you been up to this week?
Well, I've been starting to think a bit more about our virtual open studios, which of course should be, we should have signs outside our doors and banners up and people coming round, and it's happening virtually this year. So the official dates are the 19th to the 21st of June, and I am a little bit behind. I should have my work uploaded to their website and hidden behind a special place on my website. So we're trying to create it as much like a real event as possible. So I am working on getting some smaller paintings to that completion stage for that, to add to the ones that I already have. And I'm going to be doing some virtual events, which I still need to test. But at the moment, my idea is I have a focus on small painting Saturday and Studio Sunday, where all the big paintings are. And there will be a special release for people who are on my mailing list with a private view on the Thursday evening. So I've got to work out the logistics for that, but that's what I'm really starting to think about now. And having gone from thinking, oh, this is going to be, oh, I don't know how this is going to work, I'm a bit excited about it now. I think it might be quite fun.
Yeah, it sounds fun. Our North Yorkshire is doing something next weekend. Well, actually, for anybody listening, it would be already started. So it's this coming weekend. We're doing this on a Thursday. And they're doing, I don't know how you're doing it, but they're doing a series of videos. So every artist has recorded a video and they get released over the weekend, and they've got their own virtual, you know, come and visit me. But I just was so overwhelmed with other things that I just thought, I can't take that on. So I'm not involved in it, but I'm quite impressed with how many artists made a video, you know, and then they had someone edit all the videos. So they all look
really
professional.
Good.
So yeah. So how is yours working?
They've got a new edition on their website, but it's more that, they've given you more access to upload work, but people still have to contact you. So I will still be encouraging people to contact me through my website as a result of what I put up on there, because the ability on there is more limited than what I can do on my own. So on my own, I'm hoping, I've got to work out how I do embed a YouTube live stream or something I don't know. I'm going to work it out. But there's going to be extra times and things that I can do that make it fun. But, you know, we have a lot of very loyal visitors to the event. And I know that some of them were disappointed that it wasn't going to happen this year. So it will replace it. And I think it will actually stretch things out a bit longer, because certainly people who are local in the area, you know, we could have the ability to deliver paintings on a loan basis afterwards and all of that kind of thing. So there's a lot to do. But, you know, as with all of these things, there's a lot to prepare for, and I am a little bit behind.
Well, what's fantastic about it, though, I just must say, is you say, as you say, you've got lots of loyal visitors in the area, but you have lots of followers all over who can't come to Open Studios but who can come to this. And this is what's amazing about these online events, is it suddenly goes from just that region. So it's not North Yorkshire Open Studios anymore. It's open to anybody around the world to come and look at paintings and possibly buy. And that, I think, is quite exciting for people.
It is. It's going to be fun.
Well, I'm going to come and have a look.
Well, we'll see. I've got to do a test run and see if my 4G at the studio can cope with Zoom live streaming.
Yeah, I won't come and waste your time in a big, long conversation.
We do that here. We do that here. Okay, so on to the main conversation then. So, Brian, last week, it wasn't really a challenge. It's more a question that I have with my own work. Is it enough to just focus on a buttery brushstroke? And we went on, and it led to a discussion on the role of intellect in painting. And Brian suggested, which I thought was a interesting idea, I'd never thought of it that way, that thought must only happen outside the studio, but instinct and intuition is the guide while he was working. So today we just thought we'd dive a little bit more into that. So how did that strike you? Because I know that when he said that, I felt that's a really good way of thinking about it. But I also know that while I'm working, I move very quickly between those two states of thinking and working intuitively all the time.
Yeah, how it struck me when he said it, honestly, was like, phew. Because I've had this thing for a long time. Not having had years of experience of painting, and not having gone to art school, and not having all that behind me, I don't have huge confidence always in my own intuitive feelings about things, even though I know I should. And I'll get to that. But I tend to get knocked down if somebody says something the opposite to me. So anytime I've talked about having to paint with intuition and instinct, and if I don't, it goes wrong, somebody jumps in to the conversation and says, oh, but thought is so important and art needs intellect. And always somebody, it's almost like they think I mean that I just fling paint randomly. Yeah. And hope for the best. And I've never been able to articulate that it's not flinging paint randomly and hoping for the best. And after the conversation, what I realized was what I'm trying to say is that for me, my intuition is much stronger than my thinking brain. It always has been, like in life and in art. My intuition is very finely developed, but my thinking is muddled. I get myself in knots whenever I think about anything. So as a painter, like Jackson Pollock's famous quote, I don't know exactly, but a good artist paints himself or something. As a painter, I must work that way. Otherwise, I get as muddled as I do in life when I think. So for me, when I work purely through instinct and intuition and then think about it later and make sense of it later, that works for me. But any time that I try coming in with an idea and then thinking halfway through, am I expressing that idea, you know, or making notes for myself. A few weeks ago, I made a little post-it note with all the things that a painting needed, went in, did them all, killed it dead. Just awful. awful. Now it's ruined. Well, it's not ruined, but I have to start again and get back what I had. So that's what it did for me. It made me realize that it's valid for me to work that way, and that I have an intellectual thought through reason why it works for me. But it also made me wonder, so if you're not that kind of a person, most people, I think, have a more developed thought process, logic, rational, analytical side than they do intuition. If that's the artist, then is Brian's, you know, and my way of just let it come through you wouldn't necessarily work, would it?
I think the difficulty comes when you say just let it come through you. If it just comes through you and you don't have an intellectual, let's say, for what, you know, intellectual makes it sound more pompous than perhaps it is, but if you don't have an understanding of what makes a painting work in the sense that it will be satisfying to you, it will feel resolved, it's going to have the kind of effect and result that you want to have, both in your work and for other people. If you don't have that as background, as a kind of foundation to guide you, what often happens when you just say, I'm just going to paint intuitively, is you paint and it's a muddle and you can't quite sort it out, and it's ultimately not very satisfying. And I think that's where the frustration comes in. And that's where we have this balance between how much do I have to think and learn, but equally, you don't want to get to a point, of course, where you're painting to a checklist or painting to an order, or it's becoming painting by numbers, because that's not going to satisfy the other part of you either. So I think it depends what happens when you come out of that stage of painting intuitively, instinctively. Do you stand back and like what you see?
Yeah, and I think there's two different kinds of thinking I just want to distinguish between here. Yeah. So there's thinking like you're saying, so but what I found is, again, I need to do that thinking another day, not yeah. that day.
Yeah.
Anytime I try and do it that day, I ruin what I've done.
Do you mean analyzing a painting and looking
yeah,
at it?
That kind yeah. of thinking of, do I, like you say, does it work visually? Have I got the right composition? What do I need to clarify? Is it a mess? Does it need cleaning up? Personally, I have to do that later. I can't do it that same time, but I know some people can switch between that effectively. But then the other kind of thinking, there's two levels, the intellectualizing. So the what is it about, and does it say what I want it to say? I think there's two different ways of doing that. And what I've discovered in this last year is that mine has to come after. So I don't know what it's about until later.
Yes. So the concept comes from the act of painting it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I found this quote, which I just want to read to you, from a book I've got, which I only just started reading, but I've had for ages, of Squeak Carnwath. I just love saying Squeak as a first name. And she has a quote at the beginning of this book, which says, "We make a fiction to understand feelings and emotions. The remarkable thing is that creativity is not a replica of life, but rather a tool for insight. It seems that life chooses our imagining." That's a much better way of saying what I'm trying to say. So in my case, if I just let it come out and then I can step back and then I can do both levels of thinking, I seem to not get into the same amount of trouble. And I seem to be able to say, I see what that's about now. I get it. But it comes first. Yeah. Whereas I don't think that's the case for everyone.
No, and I think that makes sense to me. And I think this is the difference between looking at the painting and feeling whether it aligns with your aspirations for it, I suppose, and the idea of how much do you need a concept about what a painting is going to be about or what a painting is going to become before you've even started it. And I think if you have that, you probably, well, certainly in the way that we work, you have to hold that quite loosely at the beginning. So I might have some idea And for me, it's often just a general feeling of something that I might want to move away from and move towards. So the work that I'm doing at the moment, I want to move away from harder edges in dark spaces and move towards using softer colours, more subtle elements of a painting like line work, which means that I know that I have to subdue things. And it's very tempting to put something in that's going to be strong and have impact and all of that kind of thing. And it can be really satisfying doing that. But I know that that is a general shift I want to take, but I can't have a, is that a concept of a painting, or is that just an area that I want to investigate that I'm just trying to be more conscious of while I'm painting, so that the group of work takes me in a new direction? I don't ever want to start creating replicas. And yet it was interesting in the co-create session we had on Tuesday. We were all painting and chatting away, and somebody said to me, "What are you making?" And I said, "It's just turning into another blooming landscape, isn't it?" But you know, this landscape for me is such a broad word. It's really just a question of space and giving ourselves space. And all of the things that I put into my painting are about space, spaciousness, and areas of concentration, like what draws your attention. And that's a big crossover for me. And there are millions of different ways to do that, but that always seems to be what it comes back to. You know, what are you paying attention to? What are you noticing? What are you enjoying? Can you find something to enjoy in this, even if it's a bit of crushed rubbish or, you know, in Prunella Clough's words, a plastic bag that's caught in a tree, and you just capture the colour and the movement of it. It doesn't matter what it is, but it's that thing of paying attention amidst the whole broad expanse of spaciousness that we've got at our disposal. I don't think that's a concept, perhaps. That's just, as I paint, that's what comes up. I don't predetermine it in advance. That's just what continually pulls my attention back again.
Yeah. It strikes me while I'm listening to you talk about, you know, wanting to move away from something and towards something else. And it's very considered, the way that you talk about it. And that's what I mean about we paint who we are, because that's you. You are thoughtful and considered and not intellectual.
It's not very considered in the process of doing it.
No.
And I think that's where this division comes, isn't it? Yeah. It's how you think about it and then what happens when you're actually doing it. But I think the biggest thing that, I mean, you see and I see is people who, you're creating one kind of work and it frustrates you because it's not where you want to be. And I think there's an element of being a painter that you've just got to learn to live with that, quite frankly, because yes, that's always going to be there. And you want it to always be there.
Yeah, because like Brian said, he still hasn't made a painting that meets what he's looking to do. And he's been doing it 40 years. So if he hasn't, chances are we're never going to get there.
But I think earlier on in the stages, what sometimes happens is people have this huge gap between the kind of work that they look at, that they desire, that they want to make. And there's a big gap between that and what they are actually making. And I think at that point, it does help to get a little bit clearer about, okay, so what is it that you like and what are you actually doing that's going to help you get there, rather than, you know, if somebody says, "I like painting, you know, really big, luscious abstracts," and then they keep doing water. This is so bizarre, but I've seen it happen. I really like these big random abstracts and I just keep doing watercolor paintings of trees. Okay, so don't start with a 10-inch piece of watercolor paper and a watercolor pan then.
Yeah.
You know, because you're not going to get what you want. And it can be really sometimes as brutal as that, this disconnect that people almost don't realize. Well, you're not going to create that until you go out and you order 4-foot canvas, realize how hard it is, and then pull back from that and start working with your medium in a different scale. You know, there are so many steps, but people, it's so easy to get stuck with what you learned at the beginning part of your learning process. And for me too, you know, I started learning in sketchbooks, doing drawings of scenes on holidays, precise drawings. You do need all of that learning, but at some point you've got to make a conscious decision that you're going to move on from that. And I think that's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah,
if you want to.
So many people, you know, this is what I teach. This is what got me into teaching the class that I teach, because I realized that people, they get wrapped up. Most our education focuses on the formal principles and or the intellectual side of things. And you don't get taught to learn what you like. You don't get taught that the way you make your own work is to focus on what you're interested in, not just in life, but in the way, what brush marks do you like, or tools do you like, what colors do you like, how do you like big or small, does it feel good to you when you monoprint onto a painting, or does that feel bad, does it feel good when you use a palette knife, or do you not like it? And the way that you will eventually make work that is truly aligned with who you are is by noticing what feels good, I believe, because I think it's like life. In life, if I used to work for a company many years ago that had bad ethics, and I hated it. I hate every minute of being there, even though I liked the work and I liked the people I worked with. The company's ethics were horrible, and I felt horrible all the time I was there, because it didn't align with who I am. Same thing when we paint. If we're painting dainty watercolors, but we're really meant to paint big splashy abstracts, it won't feel good. And then we won't go into our space to work because, oh, I don't like it. I don't, you know, I feel a need to paint, but I don't enjoy it when I do it.
And vice versa as well. I think if some people feel that there is an expectation or a pressure to make big expressive abstracts, and actually really what they want to be doing is beautiful, delicate, careful, considered watercolors, you know, which are exquisite. It's this, don't try to be something that you're not.
Yes. And I think the thinking part, I think we all have to find, to get back to that idea of thinking, we all have to find what suits us. And part of the clues is in what you're drawn to. So recently there was a discussion in your group about somebody's been selected for a program, and there's a magazine associated with the program called Terps Banana. And it's a modern painting magazine. I thought, oh, I'll order a copy of that. It'll be interesting to read. And then I'm reading it, and honestly, I apologize if anybody associated with that magazine is listening, but I'm just reading it going, bollocks, bollocks, bollocks. I just don't agree with any of this. It's very elitist. There's so many derogatory comments in there about most artists that it's not for me. But the art that I love, of all different kinds, and this goes to Ted Hughes poetry as well, the art that I love is visceral and emotional and instinctive. It's not considered an intellectual. So I love Tracy Emin's paintings. There's nothing intellectual. They're like emotion on a canvas. I love Van Gogh much more than I love the Impressionists or Cézanne or the Cubists. Because I love that, I feel like I can feel when I'm standing in front of that painting, I feel him. I love Ted Hughes' poetry because it's visceral and emotional. It hits me right in my stomach. So, of course, my painting isn't going to be anything other than that. That's going to be what I like. But I think everyone needs to think about it that way. So what kind of, do I love intellectual discussions about painting?
Some people could say paintings based around or influenced by or in any way associated with Ted Hughes' poetry by definition have to be fairly intellectual. So that, you know, there is, in all of it, we have to align this degree of thinking, which of course comes on many, many different, levels.
Yeah. And we have to find out what it is for us. Like, I'm finding it very, very difficult to interpret those poems in painting. I'm just not getting there. Now that I've got more of a sense that it's actually this connection I feel with that poetry for other reasons, which is another conversation, I'm understanding more why it's not a case of just interpreting it. So yeah, there is lots of thinking, but I have to do all that thinking away from it and then come back in and just go again and then see what comes out of it. And sometimes don't you do something and then you, when you think about it later, you go, huh, look at that. I didn't know that's what that was about, but now I see it. But I really want to keep stressing because it really has bothered me in the past when I talk about intuitive painting and someone kind of puts it down. I don't want to sound like I'm putting down the other kinds just because I think, oh, bollocks, when I see that. That's because it's not my personality, but it's somebody else's, in which case it's right for them. And it's that thing of connecting with yourself to the point where you really understand. And in a way, I think that for me, that's come through painting. The more art I make, bad and good, the more I'm aware of what I'm trying to do and who I am.
Yes, and I think therefore to be aware of both of these things as you're making art and where you are in it is helpful. I'm still reading this book that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago by Chaim, Chaim Potok, called My Name is Ashalev, about what I didn't even realize is he is a real painter. So it's almost a biographical story. Anyway, I was literally just reading this morning and I thought this is brilliant for the conversation that we're having. So at this stage in the story, he is a 15-year-old boy and he has been given approval by the Hasidic Jewish community, but not by his father, to go and learn painting with a non-Orthodox Jew who is living in Manhattan. So, and they have progressed. So he's painting nude models, much to the horror of his father, because this is, you know, this is basically being led to the dark side, and it's basically not God's gift that's being given proper respect. It's all going in the wrong direction. But this is a conversation between the person who's teaching him. And he's asking me, he says, you know, what are you painting? And I said, a classmate. Do you hate him? I was quiet. You hate him and you're afraid to paint your hatred, yes? It is a false painting. It reeks of cowardice and indecision. In art, cowardice and indecision can be seen in every stroke of a brush. If you hate him, paint your hatred or do not paint him at all. One must not paint everything one feels, but once you decide to paint something, you must paint the truth or you will paint green rot. And I just thought, often we're hesitant to push ourselves beyond what we think is going to be accepted. And I think that's where this balance of it's almost like our intellectual sides put the brakes on us.
Yes.
You know, we get so bound up in thinking about it that actually what we're doing is keeping what we feel about it contained. And I think we do need both, but we need to give ourselves the okay to let that out. And later, afterwards, decide if you've pushed it through. Now, you don't have to paint paintings about hatred. I'm not saying that at all. But I think that giving yourself license to feel intuitively in painting is really important. Otherwise, you never move past those how to do it painting books, how to do perspective, how to do. You know, and it never gets past that point. And, you know, that's tricky as an artist. I mean, later on, a couple of pages on, he says, when an artist draws or paints or sculpts, he is a battleground between intelligence and emotion, between his rational side and his sensual side. The manner in which certain artists have resolved that battle has created some of the greatest masterpieces of art, and you must learn to understand this battle.
What a good book this sounds
like. Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
I mean, literally, I was just reading that when I woke up this morning before we started recording, and I thought that that's perfect. That's what it is. And some of that is that it's okay to keep having these conversations and questions with yourself about how much is thinking, how much is feeling. It's that battle. That's what we're doing.
The other thing that came up for me while I was thinking about this subject is self-acceptance. And what I mean by that is when I truly let out what I'm feeling and it actually comes out and feels like it's flowing out, sometimes it looks too raw. I've said this before, but it looks too raw to me. Yeah. And that's why I have to step away. That's why if I start thinking at that point, I mess it up. Because it is, now that I think more about what it is, what the reason I'm painting, it should be raw. And it's okay if I leave it that way. But there's a huge part of this for all of us, which is self-acceptance, which is if you see yourself on the canvas, if you don't, and Brian was saying about becoming your own best friend, if you're not your own best friend and you look at that, it can be a bit, ooh, you know, you're not, and everybody's will be different. Theirs might not be raw. Theirs might be meticulously neat. But whatever it is that you see yourself in what you've made, you have to coin an American phrase, love yourself. Because if you don't, you're not going to love what you see when you're truly yourself, when you paint. And that's a challenge too.
That's why we keep doing it, because it keeps us on our toes. So we had a question come in from Ruth, which also ties in with this subject a little bit. So I'm going to read part of the question to you. And then we thought it would be quite good fun to, we've got this fantastic book from Brian. So, and so many of you said it was lovely to hear his views on things. So we did. I did a little game and I found a page at random that is going to answer your question, Ruth. So it's a kind of ask Brian, ask the Oracle. I'm not sure how long we'll be able to keep this going for. And I hope if he's listening, I'm sure he will take this with all good intentions. But so here is the question. And we'll see how Brian's answer matches up. The question is, how do you deal with rejection of your artwork? I'm a watercolor artist and I've lately submitted 5 pieces of artwork for an exhibition by a gallery. All 5 pieces have been rejected. And mostly I'm disappointed since I enjoyed painting these pieces and I felt like I was moving on and discovering my style. I'm trying not to let the disappointment override that feeling of joy I felt while painting. Note, I must have hit on something here. Tears are in my eyes. And don't we all recognize that when you strike something true? It's the fact of not being chosen. Have you experienced these situations? How did you move on and dealt with it? So we will come back to this first. But before we do, let me just ask the Oracle of Brian, who says, art history shows us over and over that the thoughtful arrangement of form and the calibration of colour can transmit emotions, stir cognition, and astonish us in ways impossible to verbalise. That's why it's visual art. So be astonished. You can't know beauty until you learn how to recognize it. You can't take someone's breath away unless it's been done to you. So how do we tie those two things together? I think what's happening here is this gap. And when a gallery says no, there can be any number of reasons. It could be that they're not looking for that style of work, they're not looking for that approach, it doesn't fit with the idea for the show, all sorts of things that you can't know about. And we have to try not to take these things personally. But I think also in that little patch about there is a recognition that we all have when we've managed to get that sweet spot, and it is challenging in art. That's why we do it. Because if it was easy, if everybody just sat down and painted and it had that impact that can transmit emotions, astonish us and stir cognition, everybody would be up there. And we're not yet. I'm not. Brian says he's not. And certainly in this situation, Ruth, you're struggling with this feeling that you're not there yet. And that's okay. It is disappointing. It is frustrating, but that's what we're aspiring to. And when you're aspiring to something that's going to impact people like that, where they have that kind of visceral reaction to it, whether it's a, oh, that's beautiful, or oh, that's shocking, or what on earth is going on in that painting? I want to have a look closer. It's that kind of tug on emotion that we're trying to get to. So that's Brian's take on it. Stretch further, I would take from that, you know, stretch into your work. You want to be astonished and have something that's going to try and take somebody's breath away. But back to real life, how do you deal with rejection briefly? Anything else to add to that?
Oh, I get really cross, and you just think what idiots they are and how can they not see? And this should be, I get cross. It hasn't happened to me in a while because I haven't submitted to much in a while, but yeah. I just submitted to two things, and there's a very strong likelihood for at least one of them that I will be rejected. There's a very strong likelihood my paintings will be rejected. They won't be personally rejecting me. And so I'm bracing myself for that. But what I do now to brace myself for that is I know my work isn't for everyone. And I know that there are considerations about fit and everything, but there are also personal taste considerations. There are times when the jurors are looking, or the gallery owners looking for something representational and you're not, or they're, you know, there's all sorts of reasons why your work gets rejected. So I try and focus more and more on what I've achieved for myself. And what struck me about that question was, I'm sorry, was it Ruth?
Yes.
Ruth felt like she had really got somewhere with those paintings. Yeah. They moved her. Yeah. And so I think, win. That's it.
I know.
It moved you. Just
she also says in the bit that I didn't read, you know, I'm disappointed and I keep asking, are my paintings not good enough? Maybe I'm not ready yet. Are they up to standard? And you know, my side of it was to keep pushing yourself. But I agree with Louise that all of this is, it is this, where are you? Your paintings, you felt excited enough about them. They had changed maybe since last year, or the work you were doing 2 years ago. The fact that you even got to the stage where you had five pieces ready to submit together, you know, that takes a fair amount of organization and doing and getting them to that stage of being completed and photographing and all of them, all of that thing is a win.
Yeah. I mean, I think I think about rejection is, if I'm rejected five times in a row from different organizations at different levels and from places where I feel my work should be accepted, if it's just once and I feel, well, my work's on a standard of everybody else's, and if it's just once, then I'm going to dismiss that. But if it's five times in a row, let's say, then, or 10 times in a row, then I might have to think, okay, maybe I'm not up to the standard I think I am. Or maybe I'm applying to the wrong places.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I've, some things out of whack. But when it's one time, it really means to me nothing. Yeah. And thinking of what would Brian say when he said, be your own best friend, be 12 feet tall and bulletproof.
Yeah.
It's because that's what it takes to cope with that sense, which we all know, Ruth, we've all felt it, of being just kind of punched in the stomach by a rejection when you were really hoping. But it's outside validation and it doesn't last long. So when earlier in the year I had my painting accepted for that exhibition in London, which for me was a big deal, and it won a prize and somebody bought it, I was very happy and proud at each of those moments.
Yeah.
But it's not lasted into lasting self-confidence. It's not like I now walk around going...
It's a little buzz for about a week or so, isn't
it? Yeah, and then you've got all the same doubts come back. And all the so no amount of external validation will ever make you feel better, only temporarily. But the only thing that
it's damn nice to get them, though. This is the thing, isn't it? It is nice to get them. I wonder if there's something in And again, because I know that this is important for me in terms of motivation as well, are there other places where you can get that? Because it's a ratio, isn't it? It's a balance of all the things that you're doing. And if all you're getting is knock back, you need to look at other ways to redress that balance a bit. So where you get a little bit of positive reinforcement, and that could be from an art class that you're taking, from teachers' comments within that, from fellow students within that. It could even be discussions that you're having with people on Instagram. I think it helps to balance up when you have these negative disappointment things come in, think actually, well, where else are things going really well, so that you put it into perspective a little bit.
Yeah. And also, I think more than ever, just go back to that feeling that you had, because your feelings about your own work can buoy you up.
Yeah.
When other people are not validating you. And in this case, it's one other person. So who knows why that happened?
Yeah.
You know, unless it happens 20 times, I wouldn't take it anything other than a normal bump in the road of being any kind of creative person.
Yeah.
I think it was John Grisham. Is it John Grisham who got like 60 rejections for his first novel, which became one of the biggest selling novels ever in the history of novels? So, you know, the Beatles got rejected countless times before someone picked them up. It's not about quality always. It's often just about right time, right place, wrong time, wrong place.
Right, to wrap us up then this week, what has inspired you?
Oh, guess what? Last week's conversation.
Again?
Well, I just have been on a roll thinking, and I don't want to go too deep into this because I could talk forever, but when at some point in that conversation, Brian talked about humidity made him a painter, which like humidity just makes me want to run screaming out of wherever I am. But I understood what he was saying. And he talked about how we often have what we need at 10, at the age of 10, and that everything else is just. So anyway, I'm long walks, thinking, and I just pieced everything together, the Ted Hughes, so I now have my own what made me a painter. I know what it is, and it makes sense of my paintings. It makes sense of the compositions that I always end up with. It makes sense of so much. And I would just urge everybody to really like think about that, like what is it? In another course I took a long time ago, the teacher talked about how what made us want to be an artist is often a very difficult time in our lives. In Brian's case, it wasn't. It was just his home.
Yeah.
And I wanted to encourage people to think about it in a broader terms than we talked about on the podcast. It's not just place. It's not always place. It might be something else. And so in my case, I can say loneliness made me an artist. And when I say that, and that I'll have long blog posts about this, I'm sure. But when I say that, I know all the threads of where it came from. I know why I felt that way all the way through my life in different situations. And I can see that's why when I make intuitive paintings, when I truly work from intuition, I always have these isolated shapes and then this big expanse and no way of connecting these shapes. That's why connection is an important value to me more than almost anything else, making a connection. That's why Ted Hughes' poetry was so important to me when I was a teenager, because it made a connection on a really deep level with me when I didn't have a lot of other things that did. So I put all these threads together and I can't steal Brian's sentence, so I can't write loneliness made me a painter, but I can start to understand what I'm doing and why, and talk about it in a way that makes sense to other people. So it's just been, super inspirational and really quite exciting.
And also the result of quite a lot of time both thinking and doing,
Yes.
You know, the combination of seeing how it's come up in your work without you thinking consciously about it, but that has now given you the ability to look back at it with a wider degree of understanding about it.
Yeah.
And to put it all into place and to have all of those thoughts. And I think when you said, you know, about negative things, and he said, you know, humidity is not easy.
No.
Like it's that kind of heavy, oppressive sort of feeling. And we talked about this a little bit last week. I kind of agree with you. I think the drive for a lot of things comes out of, even if it's a drive towards making something beautiful, it often comes as a drive that's come away from something that was difficult. And I think these are always, they're challenging conversations to have. And also, you know, they're challenging conversations to have with yourself, because there's nobody else to prop you up in that.
Yeah.
You've got to keep investigating it for yourself into your own space and your own history and your own dialogue. And that in itself can be difficult, because it gets into the stage of like, oh, am I just being self-obsessive and selfish,
yeah,
and laser exactly. gazing and all of that. But when it gets somewhere, and I think what you described, the fact that it just clicks into place, there's a little bit, there's times where it just clicks in and it feels right. And then there'll be another period.
I can say that if I go in today going, right, I'm going to make some paintings about loneliness, then it'll all go to pot. So
yeah.
I have to forget it now.
Yeah,
I just have to think about it afterwards.
Yeah.
So how about you?
I found it a little bit hard this week, and I'm not sure if this quite fits in this area, but it's been a difficult week, I think. It's been a difficult week for us in the UK, looking at it from a distance on, you know, top of this pandemic that we're in. You know, the murder of George Floyd and what it has sparked in America. We are not free from this in the UK. And I think we're not in the same situation, because we have a different social history in our country than in the States, which impacts, but we are not free from this. But I don't think we see it to quite the same degree. And even in the way that our protests were policed yesterday in London is radically different from what's going on in the States. But what's inspired me in it is the way that everybody is trying their best to step in and see what they can do to help in a situation where it's very difficult to help, because there aren't easy solutions. Posting a black square on Instagram is not a solution.
No, that's literally the least you can do.
I don't know. I personally struggled with that, and that in itself made me question, you know, my, you know, should I be standing up for this and making a statement? And I just thought, I'm not the person to be doing this. But I have been watching a lot and listening a lot. And there was a story that one woman told. She was in a lift. She was a black woman in her 20s. Very articulate, you know, nothing special really in a way to be mentioned. But she said she was in a lift, she'd walked in, she'd said hello, people had said hello back, all of that thing fine. And then the lift doors opened, and an elderly white gentleman said, "Ladies first," stood back, let two ladies out. And then when she went forwards to walk through the lift, he held up his umbrella and blocked her and said, "I said ladies first." And I know. And she said what shocked her, she said she went into total shock, which I totally understand. But she said thinking about it afterwards, what upset her was not that he thought that, because how do you change somebody who is thinking in that capacity, but that all the people that she had had a normal good morning exchange with in the lift, nobody said anything. Now, I've never been in a position where I've seen anything to that, quite that extreme, But I know that I have been in situations where people have been treated badly and I do get involved, you know, sometimes much to the embarrassment of my children when they were younger, who said, don't get involved, leave them to it, mummy. And actually now I do think it is changing. So if I look at my children's friends and how they interact with each other, I hope it's changing. But, you know, hands on heart, I'm not in a position to understand this fully. I can't be.
No.
But I think the fact that people hopefully are listening,
I think,
and we just start to make changes and be aware of that in those small things, because it's the small things that contribute to the big things. And this has to change.
It's what gives me hope watching, as somebody who lived there a long time, so I have some understanding of that culture. And what gives me hope is seeing some of the people who are speaking out now are not the people who you would expect to be speaking out. And generally in America, it's so divided along party lines now that if you're a conservative, you believe you stick with one side. And if you're not a conservative, you go on the other side. And this has been so horrific that it has moved a lot of people who generally would have just naturally backed the police because it's the police into a different point of view, and into shocked people into recognizing something which we don't have to confront. We don't have to confront, especially living here, but white people do not have to confront on a daily basis. It's not part of our daily life. We don't have to, you don't have to, when you send your kids out, wonder if they'll get arrested or murdered by the police while they're out. That's not, but it's part of everyday life for some people to worry and wonder that. And so that's the what's given me some hope in this, is that it's awakening some awareness for people who were generally not aware.
Yeah, I hope that it is triggering those thoughts. And I think,
but not in everyone. It's not in everyone, obviously.
Not in everyone. But nonetheless, I think there has been there have been some amazing things which have been an inspirational side of it, and long may they continue, and we all do what we can.
Those people inspire me, actually, the people marching.
Yeah.
I mean, besides being frightened of the police and tear gas and whatever else Donald Trump might decide to throw at them, and still going out and doing it, they're also doing it in a pandemic. So they're also risking being in crowds in a pandemic in order to bravely make a point and make a stand. And that I found really moving.
Yeah. Yeah. So for all of you in America, you know, listening, we're watching too in the UK, is all I can say. And, you know, we're from over here, we're in support of it as much as we can be. And we know that it's a heartbreaking situation to be watching on top of everything else. So thoughts going out to all of you. And until next week, we hope you have a very happy painting week and you find moments in that that will inspire you and help you through all these lovely, challenging, wonderful things that we call life. And if you want to find out more about Louise's free challenge that she's got coming up, head over to her website, louisefletcherart.com. And if you want to see more about my open studio event, head over to my website, which is alicesheridan.com. Thank you very much for listening. And just a reminder, if you could hop over now to britishpodcastawards.com/vote, search for Art Juice and give us your thumbs up. We would really appreciate it. Thank you for your reviews and your messages about last week. If anybody wants to add a review on Apple Podcasts for us, that would be much appreciated. And we will see you again next time. Bye-bye.
Bye. Have any outtakes?
Good.
We don't make mistakes anymore. That's the problem.
I know.
Mess everything up all the time and have to start again.